This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The news came out last week, but the anger is still emerging. When Volkswagen revealed that it had installed a defeat device in as many as 11 million diesel cars worldwide, it set off a cascade of lawsuits, investigations, and questions from car owners. Answers to many of those questions still haven't been answered. What is known is that these so-called clean diesel engines are far less clean than they were promoted as and won't pass state emissions tests as they actually run on the roads. What's also known is that thousands, if not millions, of VW car owners are considering joining class action lawsuits that have already cropped up to claw back compensation for people who believe they were defrauded by the German automaker. We are going to focus on local reaction to the VW scandal today on the show, and you can share your story or your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Again, go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition to weigh in. We've already gotten some notes from people like Mark, who says, "I am definitely disappointed to hear how VW cheated its way to the mileage and performance figures that these cars can achieve. It's particularly sad because up until this major news story broke, VW diesels were some of the only cars on the market in the U.S. that offered great mileage, lively performance, and a fairly reasonable price with the option of a six-speed manual transmission." We also got a note from David who says, "I was feeling so betrayed by VW that I am producing these bumper stickers in defiance." And he sent us a mock-up. It says, "Fraudfignugen." Do you remember the whole Fraudfignugen thing of many years ago? He has a link to his bumper stickers again at vpr.net. And we're joined now by Tristram Coffin. He's a lawyer with Downs Rackland Martin, and he's leading the legal team in a class action suit against Volkswagen. I want to mention that Downs Rackland Martin is a VPR underwriter, and Robert Turneau, the lead plaintiff in this class action suit, is the spouse of VPR President Robin Turneau. Tris Coffin, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So who has actually joined the lawsuit besides Robert Turneau?
Well, Robert is the only named plaintiff, but we've received approximately 200 inquiries from Vermont diesel Volkswagen owners throughout the state expressing interest in becoming potential class members.
And what is the damage that you're claiming?
Well, our complaint alleges that there are damages related to people being deceived into buying a car that was not what it was represented to be. So those damages can include kind of non-economic values people put on wanting to have a car that was represented to be environmentally friendly and a clean diesel car, and also, you know, kind of more dollars and cents damages that would flow from the reduction in value of the resale value of the car, that kind of thing.
Why is it that you think this is something that that parties to the class should be involved in, rather than waiting for governments to fine the operators, for example, or to fine Volkswagen?
Well, there are different kinds of remedies that are available. We move forward with our complaint, and I know that various authorities have gotten involved in this as well. But you know, clearly, use of the litigation system is a way for people to seek redress for all sorts of injuries, and our complaint is seeking to do that.
So, what exactly do you hope will happen?
Well, we hope at the end of the day, fairness will reign, and you know, if the allegations in our complaint are proven to be true, that Vermont owners of Vermont Volkswagen diesels will get compensated for, you know, their loss as a result of the alleged deception by Volkswagen.
And compensated to what extent?
Well, it all depends. You know, there's an argument that they didn't get what they paid for, so they should be entitled to the full value of the car. There is a rejoinder to that, that the even if they don't get they didn't get the full value of the car, they still have an automobile, and the valuation should be somewhat less than the full market value of the car. But you know, that's something that will be determined throughout the course of the case and discovery, and ultimately a jury and a judge may decide that issue.
Can you explain how this is actually going to work when it actually comes before a jury and a judge? We got a note from Kurt who says, "How do I join the class action suit? I have a 2009 TDI that's due for inspection." But I also, you know, I want to understand better how it's all going to fit together, because there's at least one other suit that's already been filed in Vermont, and there are other suits being filed around the country. So when there are so many lawsuits filed in so many jurisdictions claiming slightly different damages, maybe asking for individual payouts of different amounts, how does that then work?
You know, it's a complicated issue when you have one of these cases that spans the country and even across different nations, how you deal with it. And you know, really, each case is its own separate entity. There very may come a time that they get consolidated either in groups of several lawsuits or one huge mega lawsuit, or different ones may exist on their own. Those are questions that will be determined as the cases go forward by the judges and the litigants, with the notion of what's the most efficient way to reach a just result in the case.
So it could be that they all sort of get bundled, or one suit goes forward and then anybody who owns these cars could be entitled to the same payout from that?
That's a possibility. More likely, there will be multiple lawsuits that will go forward, and you know, it really depends on the particular procedural facts of the case on how that all gets determined. It'll be a process that'll take a while to get sorted out, but this is something that happens with these kind of national cases on a fairly regular basis, and so there's definitely a process where courts will end up simplifying the different lawsuits, which are many, into either a handful or one larger consolidated action. But there's no guarantee that that will happen. And until we have that process occur, we're going to be going forward with our lawsuit.
We got a note from Gregor who says, I'm normally one of the least litigious-minded people you could ever meet, but in this case, unless VW offers to buy my car back, I'll be joining a class action lawsuit along with the thousands of other folks who feel similarly betrayed. VW selling a car this expensive under false pretenses requires more than a slap on the wrist. But then we also got a note from Steve who says, I'm not defending what VW did or saying they should not be fined by the EPA. However, owners were not harmed by this defect. They bought a car that's reliable, comfortable, efficient, and safe. These cars are still reliable, comfortable, efficient, and safe. Filing a class action lawsuit will only fatten a bunch of lawyers. Triscoffin, how do you respond to that?
Well, I think the question of how people have been harmed or not depends on, you know, sort of the facts that aren't really known now. You know, as we allege in our complaint, and as a lot of public revelations, including some by different government agencies and respected academic institutions, allege, there has been an element of deceit. And clearly, you know, when that kind of non-accidental intentional conduct occurs, that raises different sorts of issues, both in terms of the damages that people have suffered and the need to deter that kind of conduct. Also, I'd suggest that, you know, most people that we've heard from disagree significantly with the second of the two callers that you quoted. You know, most people would say that they feel like they've been damaged in the value of their car because one of the reasons they bought it was for it to be an environmentally friendly, clean diesel car that met all emission standards, and that isn't what they got. A lot of them bought it because they really were committed to a principle of having, you know, a car that was as environmentally friendly as the VW was represented to be, and they didn't get that. And then further, you know, I think as we allege in our complaint and commonsensically, definitely these cars are going to have an impact, feel an impact on the resale market. It's not the same car as it was before these revelations came out in terms of somebody looking to buy a used car.
Tristram Coffin is a lawyer with Downs Racklin Martin and a former Vermont U.S. attorney. He's leading the legal team in a class action lawsuit against Volkswagen. Triscoffin, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We're looking at local reaction and the local effects of the VW scandal. As many as 11 million cars worldwide that Volkswagen has admitted are cheating at emissions tests and are actually much more polluting than consumers and regulators thought. About 3,000 car owners in Vermont are affected. We just heard about one of the class action lawsuits coming out of Vermont aimed at claiming damages from VW. Listeners, if you are affected, maybe you work on Volkswagen cars, maybe you sell them, maybe you're an owner, you can tell us what you're thinking and what you still don't know. What questions do you have? Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Kathy says, I have a 2014 Jetta Sportswagon TDI. Honestly, I really like this vehicle. If a recall results in changes in how the car drives, that would be disappointing. It would further support the reality that the resale value is diminished. And let's turn now to Heidi Hales. She's the State Director of Air Quality and Climate, and she works with the Department of Environmental Conservation. Heidi, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
How big a deal is this, environmentally speaking?
We are very concerned about the public health impacts of this in Vermont. By installing the DEFEAT device, the emissions of nitrogen oxides, which are an air pollutant of concern, have been increased 10 to 40 times what the emission standards are for those cars. And those pollutants lead to nitrogen oxides in the air that we breathe, ozone formation during the warmer, sunny times of the year, and particulate matter pollution that all have adverse health effects.
And adverse health effects in what sense? I think I've heard about asthma being a concern here. What else?
Exactly. Definitely, some of the serious health effects include increased asthma attacks, shortness of breath, basically respiratory or enhancement of respiratory illness, and some potential cardiac effects.
So do you have a sense of how much may have been illegally released into the atmosphere from these cars, either in Vermont or globally?
I'd say that's an excellent question, and that's something, this is still really early on in this investigation and what we're learning about this, and that's something that that we're concerned about and we're looking forward to learning more about.
And what will that tell you once you know? I mean, that's already out there.
Right. Well, we are very focused and concerned about air pollutants that are transported into our region from other states, as well as locally produced pollutants. So we are working very hard to maintain our adherence to air quality standards, as well as to protect public and environmental health. I didn't mention before how some of these pollutants, ozone in particular, can also impact our environment. It can also threaten our trees and our crops. So we are very concerned and working towards this.
Let's go to Ethan, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Ethan. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. I just wanted to point out an article in the New York Times, I believe this morning, that was attempting to estimate the number of people who could have died from the additional nitrogen oxide released into the atmosphere by these cars. And they actually said on the upper end of the estimate, it was around 125, which ironically is the same number of people who were killed by the GM acceleration issues. So just in response to the earlier caller who said that the pictures of this car were not harmed and were that they were safe cars, that there is an estimate that these cars could actually have killed some extra people because of the extra pollution that they brought out.
Ethan, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. Ethan's line was a little fuzzy there. He says he was reading a New York Times article this morning that said approximately 100 to maybe 125 people may have died because of the environmental impact of these cars. So the question of safety, though, it's probably not the same safety as necessarily for the owners of these cars. But that question of safety and environmental concern is a big one. Heidi Hales, from DEC's perspective, do these cars need to be brought fully into compliance, or is there some sense that they may somehow be grandfathered in to, you know, to be able to avoid state emissions laws because the owners of these cars certainly weren't trying to defraud the state?
Exactly. That's a good question. Right now, since this is this is early on in this investigation, and the EPA is still learning more about exactly what Volkswagen did, that according to the EPA, car owners should know that though they've stated that these vehicles do have emissions that are exceeding standards, these violations don't present a safety hazard, and the cars are currently legal to drive. Volkswagen has been requested to come up with a way to fix this problem. So once that's been identified and we understand further exactly what has been done, then we would be looking for the cars to be repaired.
That's Heidi Hales. She's with the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation. She's State Director of Air Quality and Climate. Heidi, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
We are talking about what's going to happen in Vermont to people who own VW diesel cars that have now been shown to be far more polluting than previously thought. We've talked a little bit about how some owners are suing Volkswagen, and we've looked at what the state is contemplating as far as how these emissions might have affected the state and beyond. Heidi Hales was talking a little bit about what owners may need to do, and we're going to get a lot more about that coming up. We're going to hear from the DMV and from a lawyer with the Department of Environmental Conservation. We're also hearing from many of you expressing frustration, lots of questions. This goes in a lot of different directions. We can talk environmentally, we can talk economically, talk about actual effects on owners of these cars. We're trying to get to a lot of it today as we talk about VW and the effect of this scandal. I guess you can just call it that, the scandal here in Vermont. If you would like to weigh in, you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Begman wrote there, "I'm one of the owners affected by Volkswagen's deceit, but I also wonder about businesses that are affected. I bought my VW from the local dealer in South Burlington, and I've been very happy with their service. And I was planning on trading in my TDI this month for a new car. They are an excellent business with many employees, and through no fault of their own, they will be, I'm sure, negatively affected." Bill says, "At minimum, each VW owner should be entitled to, one, a new replacement vehicle, two, free maintenance for a year as a courtesy for their inconvenience, and three, an apology from VW that's personally signed by both the former and current CEOs of the company. Further, VW should be banned from importing any more diesel vehicles into the United States until they can prove that all of those vehicles can pass the California emissions test, which can then be independently verified by a third party." Again, you can weigh in, vpr.net, or call us. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking about the fallout from the revelation about Volkswagen diesel cars. The company admitted that 11 million of them, some branded Audi or Skoda, have been fitted with defeat devices to fool emissions testers into thinking the cars were passing governmental standards, when in fact they were far more polluting than those standards would allow. They also fooled customers, many of whom bought these cars for the combination of fuel efficiency and green credentials the company was promoting. The fixes that have been suggested for these cars to get them in line with emission standards will either be very expensive or reduce the fuel efficiency and operation of the cars, or both. And it remains to be seen how that will all shake out. We've got a lot of listeners with questions, frustrations, and ideas today, so we're going to get to some of your comments now. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. And I'm joined now by Megan O'Toole, an attorney with the Department of Environmental Conservation, and Captain William Eliverta, Chief of Motor Vehicle Safety in the Enforcement Division of the Vermont Department of Motor Vehicles. Captain Eliverta says we should just call him Jake, though. Jake and Megan, nice to have you both on the program.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit here about what happens now for owners of these cars, because we've gotten into a little bit about litigation and what the state is considering, but we have a lot of owners like Don, who just wrote in and said, please share with us, now that the story has broken, what will happen if I go for an inspection next week? I'm assuming Don is an owner of one of the cars in question. But so what happens to somebody like Don, who now needs to get an October inspection?
Well, right now, Jane, nothing different from what they've experienced in the past. What we've found out, or what we've understood, is the software change that VW has put in these specific VW vehicles is designed to basically fool the what we call OBD2 testing, onboard diagnostic testing. So quite frankly, if the machine goes into a state inspection station, the machine's going to get plugged into OBD2 sensor, it's going to recognize it's in test mode, and it's going to pass the vehicle. So for the consumer headed to the inspection station, other than other mechanical issues that may show up as part of their state annual inspection, if the machine reads it as a positive that it's working properly, the vehicle will get an inspection sticker.
Okay, so in other words, even though the owners now know that their cars are not actually passing state – well, they're passing the tests, but they're not actually compliant with state law, when they go in for an inspection, that inspection will still say you are compliant with state law and you're allowed to drive these cars.
That's correct. And the issue for the inspection station and what was learned as part of the EPA discovery was that the software, the OBD2 testing software, isn't able to detect that algorithm that's buried in the software. And so, quite frankly, the equipment out there is not able to detect that software algorithm.
I want to go deeper into what happens in the future, but just before we do, Jim wrote in to say, this highlights a flawed EPA standard that doesn't require proof of performance on a test population under normal driving conditions. He says, do we hang the engineers for meeting test criteria or equally blame the regulators for their inadequacy? So I'd love to get to both of you on that, but also to the point of, so now what, moving forward? I mean, if I'm a savvy and maybe immoral person, I'm thinking, boy, I could just get one of those defeat detectors on my Subaru. And then as it gets older, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's actually passing emissions. I mean, we could have more cars doing this. So at some point, do we have to get better testing or actual road testing?
Well, I would assume that they're probably that we'll have that discussion at a federal level as to what is detectable, what kind of software is viewable by the diagnostic equipment. I'm sure that's a discussion that will definitely be happening in the future.
And Megan O'Toole, from your perspective, what is the state thinking on those lines?
Well, Jane, EPA already has the authority to test vehicles in use, which means that they can test the emissions from these vehicles as they would be operated by a normal operator on a highway. And so that's what they've actually proposed to do now, is applied to several other manufacturers in the United States now that this has been uncovered. And initial testing that was done that ultimately revealed this defeat device was conducted by West Virginia University and confirmed by some independent research entities. And that research was duplicated by the California Air Resources Board and EPA to, you know, confront Volkswagen with this information, and which ultimately led to Volkswagen admitting that they hadn't installed a defeat device. So they do this, you know, very rigorous controlled initial testing that certifies the vehicle's emissions compliant, but then they also can do in-use testing as well.
So as Captain Eloverta Jake said, right now people can go in, take their TDI, take whatever car they have, and feel like they're fine, they're compliant with state law. But that's probably not going to stand forever. So what are you thinking is going to happen legally for owners of these cars? Are they going to be required to get some sort of fix for their car?
So we don't really know the answer to that yet. I think we're going to have to find out what the fix is that Volkswagen is proposing. No one really knows what the fix is going to be. And so once we know what the fix is and how that's going to affect the vehicle, we can better understand how that is going to apply to the consumer and the owner of the vehicle.
Let's go to the calls. Michael is calling in from Montreal. Hi, Michael. Go right ahead. Oh, I think we lost Michael. Let's
Hi.
See. Oh, you're there. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
I'm actually Brian, but that's okay. I'm calling because I'm an engineer, and the only car I ever wanted to own and the only car I had confidence owning was a generation ago when diesel rabbits were the only cars without computer controls because they're such simple machines they didn't need them, and the rules were so sloppy that it didn't matter. I'm wondering why nowadays when we're running the risk that half of the car is software and half of the car is hardware, we don't insist that all that operating software be open source. It will open up the can of worms and let somebody with smarts look into it if there is a problem. Right now it's all proprietary, and that gets really tangled. It means that everybody who wants to service their car at their favorite neighborhood garage can't do it because the software isn't accessible to that good mechanic. And in Vermont, that's an issue. I'm wondering, well, why not open source all cars and not just diesel rabbits?
Brian, thanks for the call. You know, neither of you guys are working for car manufacturers, but it's an interesting idea to think about taking an open source model for this kind of stuff, at least making it easier maybe for state inspectors and for car owners and car dealers and car repair people. I see you nodding, Captain Oliver. Does that make sense to you?
It would certainly make sense. I think with anything, you start talking open source, that opens up another can of worms of access to the cars, and can you make modifications to other than what we're talking about here today. So you do have to be very careful in this day and age with technology.
Let's go to another call. Pat is with us from Fairfield. Hi, Pat. Go ahead.
Yes. So I have two TDIs. I have a Golf TDI and a Jetta, both 2011s. And the only reason I went to the TDI was I had a big Ford Explorer, which I loved, but couldn't justify when I no longer needed the space, the impact on the environment, or the gas mileage. My sole reason for getting the TDI was the clean emissions, you know, the clean emissions and the cost of gas. And honestly, I've never even owned a foreign car before, So I never would have bought my car had it not been for the deceit that I received.
So, Pat, what do you think is going to happen for you now? What are you contemplating?
Well, I'm hoping something happens so that I can get rid of my car. I honestly don't enjoy my car. I've kept it, and if you asked any of my family members, they'd tell you I hate my car. But I've only kept it because of, you know, the impact on the environment and thinking that I was driving a good car. So I would like to get money back and get a car that is good on the environment. And honestly, an American car would be my first choice.
Pat, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. How about John calling in from Bethel? Hi, John. You're a VW owner as well?
I am, and I'm a vehemently pro-TDI owner. I think that our testing system may be flawed because you stick a probe into a tailpipe of a diesel Hummer or a one-ton truck, and that emits a certain amount of pollutants per minute or whatever the time, you know, it's a time issue probably, with volume. And here's my TDI that gets 47 miles a gallon. And I just can't see how that Hummer is cleaner than my TDI that's, you know, burning so much less fuel. So it may be putting out more NOx, per volume or whatever, but per time. But, I mean, I get down the road with a lot less pollutants than a lot of other people do.
John, thanks for the call. Let's put this to Megan O'Toole because, you know, it's sort of comparing different things, but saying how does it all wash out in the end? Couldn't these cars still, in a sense, be considered more efficient even though they're spewing more? It's sort of less over time.
Right. So from a regulatory perspective, there are certainly different regulations that apply to different classes of vehicles. And also depending on whether or not you're burning gasoline or diesel fuel in your vehicle. And so these specific standards that we're talking about when we're talking about the Volkswagen issue were meant to apply to diesel emissions specifically. And also just I should mention that the defeat device, its main purpose was meant to sense when the very specific, you know, very controlled EPA testing was occurring and then turn the emission controls on that did emit the allowed amount of nitrogen oxides and other pollutants. So it was a very savvy, very smart kind of trick that Volkswagen installed in the car's computer. So the test itself in the way that it is controlled to be create an equal playing field in all testing was, it was conducted appropriately. It was just this very savvy computer trick.
Do you see the state of Vermont suing Volkswagen? I mean, we talked about class action lawsuits, and there certainly are investigations, and the EPA and governments in more than just the United States are looking at this. But what's Vermont's approach?
So the Attorney General has opened an investigation that is pretty broad. It involves consumer issues on behalf of the state and then also environmental issues. And Vermont has adopted California's emission standards because the Clean Air Act allows states to adopt stricter mobile source emission standards. And we also have our own state regulations that prohibit the installation of defeat devices or devices that would render emission control systems in a vehicle inoperative. So we're certainly looking at violations of those specific provisions within Vermont.
So there could be an actual suit or a fine for VW?
That's under investigation, and it's also not atypical for Vermont to work with other states that implement California's emission regulations to go in and these types of litigation together. And since, you know, air is very much a shared resource across state lines, and so it's very important for Vermont to work with other states in the region that are dealing with, you know, similar ozone transport issues, like Heidi mentioned earlier, to address the issue together.
We're talking today about what is happening and what might happen in the future in Vermont for VW owners, owners of the diesel cars that have now been found to have these defeat devices that actually sort of lie to state inspectors about how much pollutants the cars are emitting. And so what's going to happen in your inspection next month, but also down the road a couple of years, and as we find out what happens with lawsuits and with fines and other governmental investigations. If you'd like to weigh in, you can post a note at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition, or you can call 1-800-639-2211. Rick's on the line with us from Adamant. Hi, Rick. What are your thoughts?
Hi. Yes, I have two questions, one pretty quick probably, and that is, what's the possibility of running biodiesel in here, in the TDIs, that would help mitigate the pollution? I don't know if that's, at least take care of some of the problem. The other thing I see, and this is in any crisis, there's an opportunity. And in my mind, this has to do with the whole issue of regulation across the board. I mean, people are complaining, oh, there's too much regulation. But this really points to the fact that, no, there isn't too much regulation. We need to, have the funding and the inspectors to really look into what's going on, in almost all areas, because this is the kind of thing that happens when that is not taken care of.
Rick, thanks for your comments. Appreciate that. Thoughts there on regulation, but a question about biodiesel. Could biodiesel mitigate the problems here?
It's my understanding that that research is still ongoing as to whether there's different emissions from biodiesel burned in a diesel engine as opposed to petroleum diesel. So I think we're still looking at new research coming out about that. So that's still to come.
Stay tuned. All right, stay tuned. Let's go to Lori calling you in from Huntington. Hi, Lori.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
So what I wanted to say was basically reiterating what Rick just said, that we need really on the federal level to strengthen the EPA. And when you have people like Jeb Bush talking about getting rid of the EPA, and that's pretty frightening. And, I fear that perhaps other companies might be doing the same thing, everything to save a buck. That's really it. Thank you.
Yeah, Lori, thanks for the call. Jake, is this something that you worry about, that other companies are doing the same thing and we just don't know about it?
That's too early to tell. But it does, unfortunately, it does raise a question. What VW has done has certainly given a black eye to not only their company, but certainly does that kind of make the consumer think twice about all the other ones and impact it? And again, somebody had mentioned earlier about just the impact to our dealerships in the state of Vermont. So, I think it's going to have far more encompassing effect on not just the VW dealerships in the state of Vermont, but all the dealerships. Are the customers going to question what you've put up on our windshields, saying this is what the emission standards are?
This must be a topic of a lot of conversation at the DMV right now.
It certainly is, because there's so much unknown coming out of it, as Megan's talked about. We are ourselves monitoring what's coming down. Obviously, we do what Trista talked about. I really do think this is going to go to a federal level. It's going to get encompassed there. And really, like I said, this broke on the 18th, and we're still playing, quite honestly, catch-up to find out what's going on. But we have posted some information on DMV's website of the EPA's link that answers some of the common questions that the people and the consumers have about this process.
And Megan O'Toole, for you, what questions are you waiting to see how they shake out and what is still to be answered?
Well, I think the issue of, the types of pollution and the amount of pollution that we can estimate was actually emitted as a result of this defeat device, I think that is of great interest to the Agency of Natural Resources and will be helpful in the investigation that's being conducted.
That's Megan O'Toole. She's an attorney at the Department of Environmental Conservation. Megan, thank you for being part of the program today.
Thank you very much.
And we've also been talking with Captain William Eliverta, Jake, as he's known around the state. He's chief of motor vehicle safety in the Enforcement Division of the Vermont Department of Motor Vehicles. Jake, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having me, Jake.
Coming up, why is the Burlington Police Department cutting ties with a Department of Defense program that transfers surplus military equipment to the nation's police departments? We'll hear from the BPD chief next on Vermont Edition. Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Burlington Police Department announced yesterday that it would opt out of a controversial Defense Department program that transfers surplus military equipment to police departments across the country. Police Chief Brandon Del Pozo joined us earlier this morning to explain the decision.
The Department of Defense decided at some point to take a lot of aging military equipment that was still otherwise serviceable, but maybe it wasn't up to the military's most modern standards, and transfer it over to municipal police departments and state police departments so that they could put that equipment to use. It included things like armored personnel carriers, night vision devices, certain types of weapons, etc.
And why did you want to end the Burlington Police Department's participation in the program?
Well, I think that, you know, after we looked at what happened in Ferguson and how the police department reacted to the civil unrest there, one of the things that really struck a chord with a lot of Americans was the imagery of these police officers that really looked, I mean, indistinguishable from infantrymen, indistinguishable from soldiers. There was this really iconic image of a police officer in a Kevlar helmet on top of a armored personnel carrier with a sniper rifle. And, you know, when I got to Burlington, you know, that's not just, it's not how I believe policing should be done. I found out that, you know, we really didn't have much by the way of surplus equipment here, just some night vision devices, and then a while ago, an old military truck that we decommissioned. So I just thought to set the right tone, just to let citizens know where this administration was coming from, that we could just opt out of this program and just say, listen, you know, we don't have anything and we're not even in a position to take anything.
Yeah, my understanding from your press release is that those night vision goggles you had actually returned earlier and that was it. That's all you had from this program. So is this more of sending a message than actually changing something in the department?
Well, it was just a matter of timing. The during my transition period, I started on September 1st, but I was in conference with the acting chief through August, Chief Jan Wright, and I told her that, listen, if the memorandum of understanding is up for renewal now, don't renew it. So you're right, they were returned. One was actually unaccounted for and taken off our books, and one was returned. This was done before I started, but it was done at my direction. And so, sure, we didn't have that much equipment to give back. But I still think that setting the right tone with Burlingtonians and Vermonters was important, especially since this is what's on people's minds now about their police.
And exactly what is it that you're hoping to convey by just changing your policy and no longer having ties with that? What is the tone that you're setting explicitly?
Yeah, well, there's a few things. I always think that the best type of police work is it's bolstered by technology and it's bolstered by equipment, but it's fundamentally about good human interactions, whether it's on patrol in uniform, whether it's during the course of investigations, whether it's dealing with protesters or whomever, citizens, complainants, people just stopping in their cars. I don't want people to think that there's some shadow army that we're building that they just haven't seen yet, that we have armored personnel carriers and night vision goggles or heavy weapons that we've gotten from the Army just lurking somewhere. We just don't have them. We do have enough tactical equipment to handle situations. We do have enough equipment in the state and National Guard repositories to borrow or to use or to request when things happen. But I just wanted to be the tone is the message is very, very straightforward. It's just what you see is what you get with the Burlington Police.
You're new to the chief's seat, I suppose you could say, and your policing career has been mostly in New York City. Have you seen the impact of this kind of military-style equipment or this policy being in place having an impact on communities?
Yeah, the thing about New York City that's curious is it doesn't have a relationship, to my knowledge, really with the feds either. But the other side of it is that the New York City budget is so big that New York City can just buy a lot of what it needs. So it does have its own armored personnel carriers and tactical equipment. But you could see sort of after 9/11, some of the street police in New York City became more tactical in appearance, especially at places like Grand Central or the Empire State Building or Ground Zero. And a lot of people lamented that. When you look at the average New York City police officer, they don't have access to heavy weapons. They don't have access to ballistic helmets. I think that's something that, you know, despite what skeptics say, that's something that New York City takes pride in, that the average rank-and-file officer is not some officer that can become a tactical officer at the flip of a switch. And I think that's something that's a good thing.
I want to mention, Chief Del Pozo, that there are other programs besides 1033 that allow police departments to get Defense Department equipment. Would it be incorrect for citizens of Vermont to assume that the Burlington Police Department no longer has any military equipment or communication systems or access to that kind of equipment?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when you talk about communication systems. This is not me being cute. I just don't know. You know, I asked my deputy chiefs and my staff for an inventory of everything that we had received from the government, and my answer was two sets of night vision goggles and a truck that's been decommissioned. You know, to my knowledge, there's nothing else that we have. I mean, to be clear, we do have rifles in our inventory that we've bought. We do have some helmets that we own, but not from the federal government or the military or the Department of Defense, no.
Well, Chief Del Pozo, thank you very much for talking with us today and explaining some of the reasoning why the Burlington Police Department is severing ties with the Department of Defense on the 1033 program.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. It was great. And thanks for being so incisive.
That's Burlington Police Chief Brandon Del Pozo speaking with us earlier this morning. Swale has staying power in the Vermont music scene. The Burlington band formed in 2002 and has released 5 albums since then. Recently, the 4-person group performed at VPR as part of our music video project Live from the Fort. Here's Swale with their song, Beaten Down.
Then you beat me down. I thought I had been around and was strong, but you showed me I was wrong. Who knew the dark night of the soul could be so wonderful? Beat, and my mind was trained to fear everything. I was so deranged. I didn't think I could go on in this solitary song, but in the breaking of the dawn I knew I could carry on. I wanted some kind of control. I was such a fool. 'Cause when there's nothing left to do, I just gotta let you do what you do. Nothing that I had done before did anything to prepare me for you. And I don't know about the pain, but true love fell down like down. Then you beat me down.
And band. That was Burlington-based band Swale with Beaten Down. Swale is Amanda Gustafson, Jeremy Frederick, Eric Olson, and Tyler Bowles. That performance was recorded as part of our video music series Live from the Fort. You can watch the video of their five-song set at vpr.net. Just click on Live from the Fort. We're still getting notes from our earlier discussion on what's going to happen in Vermont surrounding VW and the owners who bought cars thinking they were both fuel efficient and kind to the environment. We got a note from Dan who says the angriest people seem to be those who thought they were doing the world a favor by driving their choice of car. Driving cars is a current reality, but we are all damaging the world, and a lot less than we were in the 1970s. If you'd like to weigh in or listen back to our broadcast about VW, you can go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. Let's switch gears now, pun intended. The Macs are back, so are the Honeycrisps, Empires, Cortlands, and fresh pressed cider. It's apple season, and tomorrow we'll learn why it's such a great crop this year. We'll also discuss heirloom varieties being grown in the state and the role migrant workers have at our orchards. Send your apple-related questions or comments to vermontedition@vpr.net, or let us know about the apples growing in your yard, and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Liam Connors directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.